Beautiful flowers are purchased and cut and placed and arranged, and then they die in just a few days. Sasha works for a fundraising group at the Acumen Fund. He's a fundraiser for a nonprofit that addresses the debilitating effects of poverty worldwide. And they do this by funding anti-poverty initiatives around the world. Like others in his field, Sasha has been forced in the recent economic climate to do more with less resources. And as a result, he has become obsessed with only giving money to projects that produce measurable results. He wants to only give money to things that he can say, look, it made a difference here, here, and here, which of course means that he's saying no to almost everyone who passes through his door seeking funds for their particular project. To reverse this trend of saying no to every project whose outcomes could not be measured, Sasha began a month-long experiment not too long ago where he promised to say yes to every request that was made of him, personal and professional. If you asked him for something, he would do his best to give it. When he announced this on his blog, which he recommends is a very great way to announce a commitment because everybody knows about it before you've actually lived into it. When he announced this on his blog, he got all kinds of criticism from friends and colleagues. Surely, Sasha, they said, there are better ways to use your resources. You'll be throwing money away. But his critics missed the point. Sasha wasn't concerned about how his money could best be used. He was concerned about the kind of person he was becoming. He was tired of always saying no. He was hiding behind what was smart and prudent, and it was keeping him from doing what was right and good. Now, as he worked through his experiment, he said yes to beggars and nonprofit managers and friends who would ask him for $5 because they knew he had to give it. As he did all this, something strange started happening to him. He stopped focusing on measurables, and he started to see himself as a generous person. Now, 3 months after the experiment was over, Sasha ran into a homeless man he didn't recognize on this commuter train. The man looked kind of ill. Sasha guessed that he might have diabetes. The old man made eye contact with Sasha, kind of worked his way over to him and said, I just came out of the hospital. I was diagnosed as an illness. It's been healed, but I have to take medicine, but I have no money to pay for the medicine. Can you help me out? Without hesitating, Sasha gave the man $20. Not because he was certain that the man would spend the money well. Sasha gave him the money because he had become the kind of person who said yes. He'd become the kind of person who was willing to waste what he had been given on someone else in need. Is it just me, or are we all becoming just a tad bit jaded? A tad bit cynical? Instead of seeing needs, we make calculations. We feel bad for the homeless guy on the street, but we don't give him money. It's not the smart thing to do. He's probably going to buy alcohol anyway. That's what we tell ourselves. There are better ways to help that person in need. And there probably are. And I'll be honest, that's been my rationale for years. Don't give money to people. You don't know how they're going to spend it. But this passage got me thinking. It got me thinking about, is that the kind of person I want to become? Do we want to become the kind of people who judge and critique and analyze every request for help? I mean, does God give to us because we deserve it, or does God give to us because we too are in need? After graduating from a quite prestigious liberal arts college, Amanda Palmer made a choice that I don't think pleased her parents all that much. Instead of using her degree to find real work, Amanda went to work as a living statue. To pay her bills while she tried to make it as a musician, Amanda Palmer painted her face white, bleached her hair, put on a tacky, too long wedding dress, stood on a milk crate, and put a tin can at her feet. And she stood there as the 8-foot bride. For 5 years, from 9 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon, she worked the streets, making about 60 to 100 bucks a day. Now, when a passerby would drop money in her can, Amanda would hand them a flower and do her best to make eye contact with them. And when she did make eye contact with them, her eyes would say, "I see you." And often she shares, their eyes would say back, "Thank you. Nobody sees me." Each and every day as the 8-foot bride, Amanda made powerful connections with complete strangers by relying on and responding to their generosity towards her. Now, Amanda is now a very successful musician, a cross between punk and cabaret, I'm told. But despite having made it, she refuses to let go of the lesson she learned on the streets those 5 years. She still wants to connect with people. And as a result, in her music, she has made an art out of asking people for help. When Amanda rolls into town for a gig, instead of booking a hotel for her and her band, she sends out a tweet or an email asking if someone could have her crash at their place. And every time, she always finds a taker. She estimates she spent 1,000 nights in 1,000 different homes. Instead of booking a piano for rehearsal, she just asks if anyone in town has a piano she could borrow that afternoon, and almost every time she ends up in a fan's home practicing on their baby grand. If she needs food, instead of paying for a caterer, which would be the smart, prudent thing to do, she just asks, "Anybody bring food for my band after the gig?" And folks bring the most amazing homemade meals. She once asked via Twitter when she rolled into town, "Does anybody know where I can get a neti pot?" And by the time she got to the concert hall, a woman was there with a neti pot for her. Despite her success, Amanda's willingness to ask for help has allowed her to connect with her fans in a powerful way. When most stars stand above their adoring fans, she stands with them and, in fact, trusts in them to provide for her most basic needs. Now, despite this large, dedicated fan base, Amanda's first record was a complete and utter failure. Only sold about 28,000 copies. Her label was not happy. Soon after receiving this bad news, a guy walked up to her after a concert and gave her a $10 bill. "I'm sorry," he said, "I burned your latest CD from a friend of mine. Here's 10 bucks to help pay for the difference." And that interaction and others like it gave her an idea. So instead of charging for her music, Amanda Palmer decided to pass around the plate. Her concerts and her music are free to anybody. You can download them right now online onto your iPod, no cost to you. Instead of charging for her music, she gives it away and only asks that people donate what they can. She calls it crowdfunding. Much like crowd surfing, she is trusting on those who listen to her music to pay for her most basic needs. A few years ago, she began a website with the goal of raising $100,000 from donations from her fans. A few weeks later, 25,000 of her fans backed her with $1.2 million. She didn't ask them to pay for her music. She didn't tell them or make them pay for the music. She asked them to. And in the art of asking, she created a personal connection with her fans that provides a way for them to meet her most basic needs. And the results have rocked the music world. You see, God gives you enough love in all of your life. God gives you enough love and then hides and sees how you're going to use it. Will you conserve it? Manage it? Bury it away, or will you waste it on those who need it most? I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but People who are generous always have enough. People who love without limits know they are loved. People who are wasteful with the good gifts God has given them never seem to run out. But I find, I know you find, the opposite is also true. Those who are cheap are never satisfied. Those who withhold love always long for it. And those who manage carefully what they've been given never seem to have quite enough. That's because this is the nature of love. It increases when it's wasted, when it's thrown around recklessly, and it reduces when it's managed or controlled. If you don't believe me, take a closer look at today's interaction between Judas, Mary, and Jesus, for it's the perfect example of wasted love. The meal in today's story is a celebration. Lazarus has been raised from the dead by Jesus, and they're going to celebrate it with a meal. He was dead for 3 days, but Jesus, despite all logic, he's overwhelmed with compassion. He loves Lazarus. He weeps over him. And so, disregarding common sense, he raises this man who's been dead for 3 days from the grave, despite the fact that he knew that that act would be the trigger that caused people to begin planning his death and demise. In the very next paragraph, after Lazarus is raised from the dead, they plot to kill Jesus. Then there's Mary, wasting a year's worth of salary to anoint Jesus' feet for his burial, for his death. A death that we know will only be temporary. Not only is this wasteful, it's completely unnecessary. This guy's not going to die, he's going to live. And then there's Jesus' interaction with Judas. An interaction that seems soft considering the crime committed. Jesus calls Peter Satan when he tries to stop him from going to the cross. But for his betrayer, Jesus offers a gentle reprimand when he questions Mary's actions. This scene is littered with wasted love. Wasted love that leads to and points to Jesus' coming death. A death which on the surface appears to be the greatest waste of all. And yet, there in the center of all this inefficiency sits Jesus, which really shouldn't surprise us at all. He has a habit, after all, of wasting his resources when they are being used to help others in need. Think back to the wedding at Cana. They ran out of wine, so he made 180 gallons more. Hello, that's a lot of wine. Way more than could be drunk by one, let alone two wedding parties. And then when he feeds 5,000 by the sea, 5,000 hungry people, there are 12 baskets left over. Makes you question if he had any sense of planning ahead. And then when he tells Simon Peter to throw his net to the other side of the boat to catch some fish, we're told he catches 153 very large fish, more than were needed by his few hungry disciples. Wastefulness all around. As a church and as individuals, I believe if we want to be more like Jesus, we have to become more wasteful with what we have been given. We need to give a little more recklessly, love a little more passionately, and make more decisions with our hearts and not our heads. A few years ago, a pastor of a congregation near here, a congregation about our size, had the ushers pass the plate during worship for a special collection for those in need within that community of faith. After the plate was passed, at the pastor's request, the ushers counted the money and placed it in the offering plate in their chapel. At the end of the service, the pastor let the people know that at the conclusion of the service, they were invited to go back into the chapel and add to or take from the collection as they needed. If they needed some money, take some money. If they had more to give, put it in. His only requirement was they would go in one person at a time with the door closed so no one knew what you were doing once you were inside the room. Not surprisingly, no offense, but the finance committee cringed at the suggestion. The endowment board rolled their eyes. The accountants chuckled amongst themselves. They were all certain that this unregulated, unsupervised distribution of the collection would lead to utter and complete chaos. Left on their own, people would surely take too much and give too little. Well, they were wrong. After everyone had left, the ushers counted the money one more time. And after hundreds of people had gone into the room, there was more money in the collection plate and not less. Amen.